I am not a natural runner. Too heavy-legged, too big and bulky. I am built like a butcher, and honestly, I derive little pleasure from running. I do it because I have to. If I don't, I get fat, an unhappy tendency I inherited from my mother's side, all stout-bodied peasant stock from Eastern Europe, Scotland, and points unknown. So most mornings around 6 or 6:30, I galumped through the streets and the jogging paths in Cold Spring Park until I had pounded out my daily 3 miles. I was determined to keep on doing it even after Jacob was indicted. No doubt the neighbors would have preferred that we barbers not show our faces, particularly in Cold Spring Park. I did accommodate them somewhat. I ran early in the morning. I kept my distance from others. I bowed my head like a fugitive when passing a jogger going the opposite direction. And of course I never ran near the murder site. But I decided from the start that for my own sanity I would hold on to this aspect of before life. The morning after our initial conference with Jonathan, I experienced that elusive oxymoronic thing, a good run. I felt light and fast. For once, running was not a series of leaps and thuds, but, and I don't mean to be too poetic about this, like flying. I felt my body rush forward with a kind of natural ease and predatory speed, as if I had always been meant to feel like this. I don't know why it happened, exactly, though I suspect the added anxiety of the case flooded my system with adrenaline. I moved quickly through Cold Spring Park in the damp chill, around the loop that follows the perimeter of the park, hopping over tree roots and rocks, leaping the little pools of rainwater and the squelching mud patches that dot the park in spring. I felt so good, in fact, that I ran past my usual park exit and went on through the woods a little farther, to the front of the park where, with only the vaguest intention or design in my head, but a conviction, fast growing into a certainty, that Leonard Patz was the one, I came out into the parking lot of the Windsor Apartments. I padded around the parking lot a bit. I did not have the vaguest idea where Patz's apartment was. The buildings were plain blocks of red brick, 3 stories high. I found Patz's car, a rusting plum-colored late-90s Ford Probe whose description I remembered from Patz's file among the details Paul Duffy had begun to gather. It was just the sort of car a child molester ought to drive. The vehicular embodiment of a pedophile is precisely a plum-colored late-90s Ford Probe. Short of flying the NAMBLA flag from the antenna, the car could not have suited the man better. Patz had adorned his pedomobile with various disarming badges— a Teach Children Massachusetts vanity plate, bumper stickers for the Red Sox and the World Wildlife Fund with its cuddly panda logo. Both doors were locked. I cupped my hands over the driver's window to peer inside. The interior was immaculate, if worn. At the entrance to the nearest apartment building, I found the buzzer for his apartment. Patz, L. The apartment complex was beginning to stir. A few residents straggled out to their cars or to make the short walk to Dunkin' Donuts just down the street. Most wore business clothes. One woman coming out of Patz's building held the door open for me politely. There is no better disguise for a stalker in the suburbs than to present oneself as a clean-shaven Caucasian in jogging clothes. But I declined with a thankful expression. What would I do inside the building? Knock on Patz's door? No, not yet, at least. The idea was only just forming in my head that Jonathan's approach was too timid. He was thinking too much like a defense lawyer, content to put the Commonwealth to its burden, win it on cross, poke a few holes in LeJudas's case, then argue to the jury that, yes, there was some evidence against Jacob, but it wasn't enough. I preferred to attack, always. To be fair, this was a misinterpretation of what Jonathan had said and badly underestimated him. But I knew, and Jonathan surely did as well, that the better strategy is to offer the jury an alternative narrative. The jurors would want to know naturally if Jacob did not do it, who did. We had to offer them a story to satisfy that craving. We humans are swayed more by stories than by abstract concepts like burden of proof or presumed innocent. We are pattern-seeking, storytelling animals, and have been since we began drawing on cave walls. Patz would be our story. That sounds calculating and dishonest, I realize, as if the whole thing was a matter of trial tactics, so let me add that in this case the counter-narrative happened to be true. Patz actually did do it. I knew it. It was only a matter of showing the jury the truth. That was all I ever wanted with respect to Pats, to follow the evidence, play it straight, as I always had. You will say I'm protesting too much, making myself sound too virtuous, arguing my own case to a jury. Well, I acknowledge the illogic. Pats did it because Jacob did not. But the illogic was not apparent to me then. I was the boy's father. And the fact is, I was right to suspect Pats. Chapter 12. Confessions. Bringing in a shrink was Jonathan's idea. It was standard procedure, he told us, to seek a competency and criminal responsibility evaluation. But a quick Google search revealed that the shrink he chose was an authority on the role of genetic inheritance in behavior. Despite what he had said about the absurdity of a murder gene, Jonathan was preparing to confront the issue if need be. I was convinced that whatever the scientific merit of the theory, LeJudas would never be allowed to argue it to the jury. The argument was bogus, just a slicked-back, scienced-up version of an ancient courtroom trick, what lawyers call propensity evidence. The defendant tends to do stuff like this, so he probably did it here too, even if the prosecution can't prove it. It's simple. The defendant is a bank robber. A bank has been robbed. We all know what happened here. It is a way for the prosecution to tempt the jury with a wink and a nudge to convict despite a weak case. No judge would let LeJudas get away with it. Equally important, the science of genetically influenced behavior simply had not matured enough to be admitted in court. It was a new field, and the law purposely lags behind science. The courts cannot afford to make mistakes by taking chances on cutting-edge theories that may not prove out. I did not blame Jonathan for preparing to challenge the murder gene theory. Good trial preparation is really over-preparation. Jonathan had to be prepared for everything, even the 1 in 100 chance the judge might admit murder gene evidence. What bothered me was that he did not confide in me what he was up to. He did not trust me. I had fooled myself that we would act as a team, fellow lawyers, colleagues. But to Jonathan, I was just a client. Worse, I was a crazy, unreliable client, one who had to be misled. Our meetings with the shrink took place on the campus of McLean Hospital, the mental hospital where Dr. Elizabeth Vogel practiced. We met in a bare, bookless room. It was sparsely furnished with a few chairs and low tables. African masks hung on the wall. Dr. Vogel was a big woman, not flabby. On the contrary, she had none of the pale softness of an academic, though she was one. She taught and researched at Harvard Medical School as well as McLean. Rather, Dr. Vogel had broad shoulders and a great square carved head. She was olive-skinned and, in May, already very tan. Her hair, mostly gray, was cut short. No makeup. A constellation of 3 diamond studs was arrayed on her brown earlobe. I imagined her hiking up sun-blasted mountain trails every weekend, or bashing her way through the waves off Truro. She was big in the sense of prominent, too, a big shot, which only enhanced her imposing quality. It was not clear to me why such a woman would choose the quiet patient work of psychiatry. Her manner suggested a low tolerance for bullshit, of which she must have listened to quite a lot. She did not just sit there and nod, as shrinks are supposed to do. She leaned forward, tilted her head as if to hear you better, as if she was avid for good frank talk, for the real story. Lori confessed everything to her willingly, eagerly. In this earth mother, she felt she had a natural ally, an expert who would explain Jacob's problems, as if the doctor was on our side. In long question-answer exchanges, Lori tried to draw on Dr. Vogel's expertise. She quizzed the doctor. How to understand Jacob? How to help him? Lori did not have the vocabulary, the specific knowledge. She wanted to extract those things from Dr. Vogel. She seemed unaware, or maybe just unconcerned, that Dr. Vogel was extracting from her as well. To be clear, I do not blame Lori. She loved her son and she believed in psychiatry, in the power of gab. And of course she was shaken. After a few weeks living with the fact of Jacob's indictment, the strain was beginning to tell. She was vulnerable to a sympathetic ear like Dr. Vogel's. But for all that, I could not just sit there and let it happen. Lori was so determined to help Jacob, she nearly hung him. In our first meeting with the shrink, Lori offered this rather startling confession. When Jacob was a baby, I used to be able to tell from the sound of his crawl when he was in a scary mood. I know that sounds outrageous, but it's true. He would come storming down the hall on all fours, and I just knew. You knew what? I knew I was in for it. He would go on rampages. He'd throw things. He'd scream. There was nothing I could do with him. I'd just put him in his crib or his pack and play, and I'd walk away. I'd let him scream and thrash till he calmed down. Don't all babies scream and thrash, Lori? Not like this, not like this. I said, that's ridiculous. He was a baby. Babies cry. Andy, the doctor purred, let her speak. You'll have your turn. Go on, Lori. Yes, go on, Lori. Tell her how Jacob pulled the wings off flies.
Doctor, you'll have to forgive him. He doesn't believe in this, in talking honestly about private things.
That's not true. I do believe in it.
Then why don't you ever do it?
It's a talent I don't possess.
Talking?
Complaining.
No, this is called talking, Andy, not complaining. And it's a skill, not a talent. You could learn it if you wanted to. You can talk for hours in court.
That's different.
Because a lawyer doesn't have to be honest.
No, it's just a different situation, Lori. There's a time and a place for everything.
My God, Andy, we're in a psychiatrist's office. If this isn't the time and place...
Yes, but we're here for Jacob, not us, not you. You need to remember that.
I think I remember why we're here, Andy. Don't worry, I know exactly why we're here.
Do you? You're not talking like you know it.
Don't lecture me, Andy.
Dr. Vogel said,
hold on, I want to make something clear. Andy, I was hired by the defense team. I work for you. There's no need to hide anything from me. I'm on Jacob's side. My findings here can only help your son. I'll submit my report to Jonathan, then you all can decide what to do with it. It's entirely your decision.
And if we want to throw it in the trash?
You can. The point is our conversation here is entirely confidential. There's no reason to hold back. You don't need to defend your son, not in this room. I only want the truth about him.
I made a sour face. The truth about Jacob. Who could say what that was? What was the truth about anyone?
All right, Dr. Vogel said. Lori, you were describing Jacob as a baby. I'd like to hear more about that. From the time he was 2, other kids started getting hurt around Jacob.
I gave Lori a hard look. She seemed ethereally unaware of the danger of frankness. But Lori returned my glare with a fierce look of her own. I cannot say for certain what she was thinking. Lori and I did not talk as much or as easily since the night I confessed my secret history. A little curtain had come down between us, but clearly she was in no mood for lawyerly advice. She meant to have her say.
She said, "It happened several times. At daycare once, Jacob was toddling on the top of a play structure when another boy fell off. The boy needed stitches. Another time, a little girl flew off the monkey bars and broke her arm. A boy down the street rode his tricycle down a steep hill. That boy needed stitches, too. He said Jakey pushed him."
"How often did these things happen?"
"Every year or so. Jacob's daycare teachers told us all the time that they could not take their eyes off him. He was too rough. I was scared to death he would get kicked out of daycare. Then what would we do? I was still working at the time, teaching. We needed daycare. There were long waiting lists at all the other daycare centers. If Jacob got thrown out, I'd have to stop working. We actually put our name on the list at another daycare just in case."
"Oh, my God, Lori, he was 4 years old. This is years ago. What are you talking about?"
"Andy, really, you have to let her speak or this just won't work."
"But the time she's talking about, Jacob was 4 years old."
"Andy, I understand where you're coming from. Just let her finish. Then you'll have a turn, all right?"
"All right."
"Lori, I'm curious. What did the other kids at daycare think of him?"
"Oh, the kids? I don't know. Jacob had very few playdates, so I imagine the other kids didn't like him especially."
"And the parents?"
"I'm sure they didn't want their kids to be alone with him, but none of the moms ever said anything to me about it. We were all too nice for that. We didn't criticize each other's kids. Nice people don't do that except behind each other's backs."
"What about you, Lori? What did you think about Jacob's behavior?"
"I knew I had a difficult child. I did. I knew he had some behavior problems. He was rambunctious. He was a little too rough, a little too aggressive."
"Was he a bully?"
"No, not exactly. He just didn't think about other kids, how they would feel." Was he short-tempered? No.
Mean?
Mean. No, mean isn't the word for it either. It was more like, I don't know what to call it exactly. He just couldn't seem to imagine how other kids would feel if he pushed them down, so he was hard to control. I guess that's it. He was hard to control. But a lot of boys are like that. That's how we talked about it at the time. A lot of boys go through this. It's a phase. Jacob will outgrow it. Well, that was how we looked at it. I was horrified when other kids got hurt, of course, but what could I do? What could we do?
What did you do, Lori? Did you ever try to get help?
Oh, we talked about it endlessly, Andy and I. Andy always told me not to worry. I asked the pediatrician about it, and he told me the same thing. Don't worry. Jake is still very little. It will pass. They made me feel a little crazy, like I was one of those crazy, jumpy moms always hovering over their kids, freaking out about Band-Aids and peanut allergies. And here was Andy and the pediatrician saying, it will pass, it will pass.
But it did pass, Lori. You were overreacting. The pediatrician was right.
Was he? Honey, look where we are. You never want to face this.
Face what?
That maybe Jacob needed help. Maybe it's our fault. We should have done something.
Done what? Or else what?
Her head drooped, hopeless. The memory of these early childhood incidents haunted her, as if she had seen a shark's fin that disappeared underwater. It was lunacy.
Lori, what are you suggesting? This is our son we're talking about.
I'm not suggesting anything, Andy. Don't make this a loyalty contest or a fight. I'm just wondering about what we did back then. I mean, I don't know what the answer was. I have no idea what we should have done. Maybe Jake needed medication or counseling. I don't know. I just can't help thinking we must have made mistakes. We must have. We tried so hard and meant so well. We don't deserve all this. We were good, responsible people, you know? We did everything right. We weren't too young. We waited. In fact, we almost waited too long. I was 36 when I had Jacob. We weren't rich, but we both worked hard, and we had enough money to give the baby everything he needed. We did everything right, and yet here we are. It isn't fair.
She shook her head and murmured, "It isn't fair." Beside me, Lori's hand rested on the arm of her chair. I thought I might lay my hand on hers to soothe her, but in the moment it took to consider it, she withdrew her hand and knotted her arms down tight over her belly. She said,
"I look back on us then, and I see we weren't ready at all. I mean, no one ever is, right? We were kids. I don't care how old we were kids, and we were clueless, and we were scared shitless, like all new parents. And, I don't know, maybe we made mistakes."
"What mistakes, Lori? Really, you're being dramatic. It just wasn't that bad. Jacob was a little boisterous and rough. Is that really such a big deal? He was a little boy. Some kids got hurt because four-year-olds get hurt. They totter around and three-quarters of their body weight is in their enormous heads, so they fall down and crash into things. They fall off play structures. They fall off bicycles. It happens. They're like drunks. Anyway, the pediatrician was right. Jacob did outgrow it. This stuff all stopped when he got older. You're beating yourself up, but there's nothing to feel guilty about, Lori. We didn't do anything wrong."
"That's just what you always used to say. You never wanted to admit anything was out of place. Or maybe you just never saw it. I mean, I'm not blaming you. It wasn't your fault. I see that now. I understand what you were dealing with, what you must have been carrying around inside."
"Oh, don't put it on that."
"Andy, it must have been a burden."
"It wasn't, ever. I promise you."
"All right, whatever you say. But you need to think about the possibility that you don't see Jacob objectively. You're not reliable. Dr. Vogel needs to know that."
"I'm not reliable?"
"No, you're not."
Dr. Vogel was watching, saying nothing. She knew my backstory, of course. It was the reason we hired her, an expert on genetic wickedness. Still, the subject embarrassed me. I fell silent, ashamed. The psychiatrist said,
"Is that true, Lori? Jacob's behavior got better as he got older?"
"Yes, in some ways. I mean, it was better, certainly. Kids weren't getting hurt around him anymore, but he still misbehaved."
"How?"
"Well, he stole. He always stole, his whole childhood. From stores, from CVS, even from the library. He would steal from me. He'd go right into my purse. I caught him shoplifting a couple of times when he was little. I talked to him about it, but it never made any difference. What was I supposed to do, cut off his hands?
I said, "This is totally unfair. You're not being fair to Jacob."
"Why? I'm being honest."
"No, you're being honest about how you feel, because Jacob's in trouble and you feel responsible somehow, so you're reading back into his life all these terrible things that just weren't there. I mean, really, he stole from your purse? So what? You're just not giving the doctor an accurate picture. We're here to talk about Jacob's court case."
"So?
So what does shoplifting have to do with murder? What's the difference if he took a candy bar or a pen or something from CVS? What on earth does that have to do with Ben Rifkin being brutally stabbed to death? You're lumping these things together like shoplifting and bloody murder are the same thing. They're not."
Dr. Vogel said, "I think what Lori is describing is a pattern of rule-breaking. She's suggesting that Jacob, for whatever reason, can't seem to stay within the bounds of accepted behavior."
"No, that's a sociopath."
"No, what you're describing,
no, is a sociopath. Is that what you're saying, Jacob is a sociopath?"
"No."
Dr. Vogel put up her hands.
"I didn't say that, Andy. I did not use that word. I'm just trying to get a complete picture of Jacob. I haven't come to any conclusions about anything. My mind is wide open."
Lori said, earnest and grave, "I think Jacob may have problems. He may need help." I shook my head.
"He's our son, Andy. It's our responsibility to take care of him."
"That's what I'm trying to do."
Lori's eyes glistened, but no tears came. She had already done her crying. This was a thought she'd been holding inside a while, working it through, arriving at this awful conclusion. "I think Jacob may have problems."
Dr. Vogel said with treacherous compassion,
"Lori, do you have doubts about Jacob's innocence?"
Lori swiped her eyes dry and sat up stiff-backed.
"No."
"It sounds like you might."
"No."
"You're sure?"
"Yes, he's not capable of this. A mother knows her child. Jacob's not capable of this."
The psychiatrist nodded, accepting the statement, even if she did not quite believe it. Even, for that matter, if she did not believe that Lori believed it.
"Doctor, do you mind if I ask you something? Do you think I made mistakes? Was there a pattern there that I missed? Was there something more I should have done, if I'd been a better mom?"
The doctor hesitated for just a moment. On the wall above her, two of the African masks howled.
"No, Lori, I don't think you did anything wrong at all. Honestly, I think you need to stop beating yourself up. If there was a pattern there, if there was a way to predict Jacob was heading for trouble, I don't see how any parent could have recognized it, not based on what you've told me so far. A lot of kids have the sort of issues Jacob had, and it means nothing at all."
"I did the best I could."
"You did fine, Lori. Don't do that to yourself. Andy's not wrong. What you've described so far, you did what any mother would have done. You did the best you could for your child. That's all anyone can ask."
Lori held her head up, but there was a brittleness about her. It was like watching tiny thread-like cracks begin to spread and craze over her. Dr. Vogel seemed to perceive this fragile quality too, but she could not have known how entirely new it was. How changed Lori already was. You had to really know Lori and cherish her to appreciate what was happening. Once my wife read so constantly that she would hold a book in her left hand while she brushed her teeth with the right. Now she never picked up a book. She could not muster the concentration or even the interest. Before, she had this way of focusing on whomever she spoke to so that you felt you were the most impossibly captivating person in the room. Now, her eyes wandered, and she seemed not to be in the room herself. Her clothes, her hair, her makeup all were a bit wrong, a bit mismatched and sloppy. The quality that had always made her shine, a youthful, eager optimism, had begun to fade. But of course you had to know her before in order to see what Lori had lost. I was the only one in the room who understood what was happening to her. Still, she was nowhere near surrender.
"I did the best I could," she announced with a sudden unconvincing resolve.
"Lori, tell me about Jacob now. What is he like?" She smiled at the thought of him.
"He's very smart, very funny, very charming, handsome. She actually blushed a little at the word handsome. Mother love is love, after all.
He's into computers. He loves gadgets, video games, music. He reads a lot.
Any problems with temper or violence?
No.
You've been telling us Jacob had issues with violence when he was a preschooler.
It stopped as soon as he got to kindergarten.
I'm just wondering if you still have any concerns about it. Does he still behave in any way that disturbs or worries you?
She already said no, doctor.
Well, I want to explore it a little further.
It's okay, Andy.
No, Jacob's never violent anymore. I almost wish he would act out more. He can be very hard to communicate with.
He's hard to read. He doesn't talk a lot. He broods. He's very introverted. Not just shy, I mean he introverts his feelings. His energy is all directed inward. He's very remote, very guarded. He smolders. But no, he's not violent.
Does he have other ways to express himself? Music, friends, sports, clubs, whatever?
No, he's not much of a joiner, and he only has a few friends. Derek, a couple of others.
Girlfriends?
No, he's too young for that.
Is he?
Isn't he?
The doctor shrugged.
Anyway, he's not mean. He can be very critical, caustic, sarcastic. He's cynical. 14 years old and he's already cynical. He hasn't experienced enough to be cynical, has he? He hasn't earned it. Maybe it's just a pose. It's how kids are today, arch, ironic.
Those sound like unpleasant qualities.
Do they? Oh, I don't mean them to. Jacob's just complicated, I think. He's moody. You know, he likes to be the angry boy, the nobody-fucking-understands-me boy.
This was too much. I snapped, Lori, come on, that's every teenager, the angry boy, the nobody-fucking-understands-me boy. Come on! What you've just described is every adolescent on Earth. It's not a kid, it's a barcode.
Maybe, Lori bowed her head. I don't know. I always thought maybe Jacob should see a shrink.
You've never said he should see a shrink.
I didn't say I said it. I said I wondered if it was the right thing to do, just so he would have someone to talk to.
Dr. Vogel growled, Andy?
Well, I can't just sit here.
Try. We're here to listen to each other, to support each other, not argue.
Look, I said exasperated, enough is enough. The whole presumption of this conversation is that Jacob has something to answer for, to explain. It's just not true. A horrible thing happened, all right? Horrible. But it's not our fault. It's certainly not Jake's fault. You know, I'm sitting here and I'm listening and I'm thinking, what the hell are we talking about? Jacob had nothing to do with Ben Rifkin getting killed. Nothing. But we're all sitting here talking about Jake as if he's some kind of freak or monster or something. He's not. He's just an ordinary kid. He has his flaws like every other kid, but he had nothing to do with this. I'm sorry, but somebody has to stand up for Jacob here.
Dr. Vogel.
Andy, looking back, what do you think about all those kids who got hurt around Jacob? All the kids falling off playground structures and crashing bicycles. Was it all just bad luck? Coincidence? How did you think about it?
Jacob had a lot of energy. He played too rough. I acknowledge that. It's something we dealt with when he was a kid, but that's all it was.
I mean, this all happened before Jake got to kindergarten. Kindergarten!
And the anger? You don't think Jacob has an issue with anger?
No, I don't. People get angry. It's not an issue.
There's a report here from Jacob's file that he punched a hole in the wall in his bedroom. You had to call a plasterer. This was just last fall. Is that true?
Yes, but how did you get that?
Jonathan?
That was for Jacob's legal defense only.
That's what we're doing here, preparing his defense.
Is it true? Did he punch a hole in the wall?
Yes, so what?
People don't generally punch holes in walls, do they?
Sometimes they do, actually.
Do you?
Deep breath. No.
Lori thinks you may have a blind spot about the possibility of Jacob being violent. What do you think of that?
She thinks I'm in denial.
Are you?
I shook my head in a stubborn, melancholy way like a horse swaying its head in a narrow stall.
No, just the opposite. I'm hyper-alert to these things. I'm hyper-aware. I mean, you know my background. My whole life,
deep breath. Look, you're always concerned when kids get hurt, even if it's an accident. You never want to see something like that. And you're always concerned when your own kid behaves in ways that are disturbing. So yes, I was aware of these things. I was concerned. But I knew Jacob. I knew my kid, and I loved him, and I believed in him, and I still do. I'm sticking with him.
We're all sticking with him, Andy. That's completely unfair. I love him, too. It's got nothing to do with that.
I never said you didn't, Lori. Did you hear me say you didn't love him?
No, but you always retreat to that. I love him. Of course you love him. We both love him. I'm just saying you can love your child and still see his flaws. You have to see his flaws, otherwise how can you help him?
Lori, did you or did you not hear me say you didn't love him?
Andy, that's not what I'm saying. You're not listening.
I am listening. I just don't agree with you. You're drawing this picture of Jacob as violent and moody and dangerous, based on nothing, and I just disagree. But if I disagree, you say I'm being dishonest or unreliable. You're calling me a liar.
I did not call you a liar. I've never called you a liar.
You didn't use the word, no.
Andy, no one's attacking you. There's nothing wrong with admitting your son might need a little help. It doesn't say anything about you.
The comment bayoneted me, because of course Lori was talking about me. This whole thing was completely about me. I was the reason, the only reason, she thought our son might be dangerous. If he were not a barber, no one would ever have parsed his childhood so closely for signs of trouble. But I remained silent. What was the use? There was no defense to being a barber. Dr. Vogel said cautiously,
"Okay, maybe we should just stop here. I'm not sure it would be productive to go on much longer. This isn't easy for anyone, I realize. We've made some progress. We can try again next week."
I looked down at my lap, avoiding Lori's eyes, ashamed, though for what I was not exactly sure.
"Let me just ask you both one last question. Maybe we can leave on a happier note, okay? So let's assume for a moment that this case will go away. Assume that in a few months the case will be dismissed and Jacob will be free to go and do whatever he pleases. Just as if this case had never happened. No qualifications, no lingering shadows, nothing at all. Now, if that were to happen, where would you see your son in 10 years? Lori?
Wow. I can't think that way. I'm just getting through from one day to the next, you know. 10 years is just too hard to imagine.
Okay, I understand. But just as a thought exercise, try. Where do you see your son in 10 years?
Lori considered. She shook her head.
I can't. I don't even like to think about it. I just can't envision anything good. I think about Jacob's situation constantly, Doctor, constantly. And I can't see how this story could end happily. Poor Jacob. I just hope, you know, that's all I can do. But if I think about when he's older and we're not around? I don't know, I just hope he's okay.
That's all?
That's all.
All right, how about you, Andy? If this case disappeared, where would you see Jacob in 10 years?
If he walks on this case?
That's right.
I see him happy.
Happy, okay.
Maybe with someone, a wife who makes him happy, maybe a father, with a son.
Lori shifted.
But through with all this teenage crap, all the self-pity, the narcissism. If Jacob has a weakness, it's that he doesn't have the kind of discipline it takes. He's self-indulgent. He doesn't have the, I don't know, the steel.
Dr. Vogel, the steel to do what?
Lori looked at me across her shoulder, curious. We all heard the answer in our heads, I think, even Dr. Vogel. The steel to be a barber.
To grow up, I said weakly. To be an adult?
Like you?
No, not like me. Jake's got to do it his own way, I know that. I'm not one of those dads.
I pulled my elbows into my lap as if trying to squeeze through a narrow passageway.
Jacob doesn't have the kind of discipline you had as a kid?
No, he doesn't.
Why does that matter, Andy? What is he stealing himself for, or against?
The two women shared a glance, the briefest eye tap. They were studying me, together, understanding each other, judging me unreliable, in Lori's word.
Life, I murmured.
Jacob's got to steel himself against life, same as every other kid.
Lori leaned forward, elbows on knees, and she took my hand.
Chapter 13. 179 Days. After the catastrophe of Jacob's arrest, every day had an unbearable urgency. A dull, constant anxiety set in. In some ways, the weeks that followed the arrest were worse than the event itself. We were all counting the days, I think. Jacob's trial was scheduled for October 17th, and the date became an obsession. It was as if the future, which we had formerly measured by the length of our lives, as everyone does, now had a definite end point. Whatever lay beyond the trial, we could not imagine. Everything, the entire universe, ended on October 17th. All we could do was count down 179 days until then. This was something I did not understand when I was like you, when nothing had ever happened to me. How much easier it was to endure the big moments than the in-between times, the non-events, the waiting. The high drama of Jacob's arrest, his arraignment in court, and so on. Bad as those were, they barreled past and were gone. The real suffering came when no one was looking, during those 179 long days. The unoccupied afternoons in a quiet house, when worry silently engulfed us. The intense awareness of time. The heaviness of the passing minutes. The dizzying, trippy sense that the days were both too few and too long. In the end, we were eager for the trial, if only because we could not stand the waiting. It was like a death watch. One night in May, 28 days after the arrest, 151 still to go, the three of us were sitting at the dinner table. Jacob was sullen. He rarely lifted his eyes from his plate. He chewed his food noisily, like a little kid, making wet squishing sounds, a habit he had since he was a little kid. "I don't understand why we have to do this every night," he said in an offhand way. "Do what?" "Have, like, a big sit-down dinner, like it's a party or something. It's just the three of us." Lori explained, not for the first time. "It's pretty simple, really. That's what families do. They sit down and have a proper dinner together." "But it's just us." "So?" "So it's like every night you spend all this time cooking for three people. Then we sit down and eat for, like, 15 minutes. Then we have to spend even more time after doing all the dishes, which we wouldn't even have if you didn't make such a big deal about it every night." "It's not so bad. I don't see you doing too many dishes, Jacob." "That's not the point, Mom. It's just a waste. We could just have pizza or Chinese or whatever, and the whole thing would be over in like 15 minutes." "But I don't want the whole thing to be over in 15 minutes. I want to enjoy dinner with my family." "You actually want it to take an hour every night?" "I'd prefer 2 hours. I'll take what I can get." She smirked, sipped her water. "We never made a big deal about dinner before." "Well, we do now." "I know why you're really doing it, Mom." "Yeah, why's that?" "So I won't get all depressed. You think if I just have a nice family dinner every night, my case will just go away." "Well, I certainly don't think that." "Good, because it's not going away." "I just want it to go away for a little while, Jacob. Just 1 hour a day. Is that really so awful?" "Yes, because it doesn't work. It makes things worse. It's like the more you pretend everything is so normal, the more you remind me how unnormal it really is. I mean, look at this." He waggled his arms around, flummoxed by the old-fashioned Hamish dinner Lori had made. Chicken pot pie, fresh string beans, lemonade with a cylindrical candle for a centerpiece. "It's fake normal." "Like jumbo shrimp," I said.
"Andy, shush. Jacob, what do you want me to do? I've never been in this situation before. What should a mom do? Tell me and I'll do it."
"I don't know. If you want to keep me from getting depressed, give me drugs, not chicken pot pie."
"I'm afraid I'm all out of drugs at the moment."
"Jake," I said between bites, "Dara could probably hook you up."
"That's very helpful, Andy." "Jacob, has it ever occurred to you that the reason I make dinner every night, and the reason I don't let you eat in front of the TV, and the reason I don't let you stand around the kitchen eating your dinner out of Tupperware or skip dinner altogether and stay up in your room playing video games, is because of me? Maybe this is all for me, not you. This isn't easy for me either."
"Because you don't think I'm going to get off."
No.
The phone rang.
Yes, I mean, obviously, otherwise you wouldn't need to count every dinner.
No, Jacob.
It's because I want to have my family around me. When times are tough, that's what families do. They gather around, they support each other. Everything isn't always about you, you know. You need to be there for me, too.
There was a moment's silence. Jacob seemed unabashed at his adolescent self-absorbed narcissism. He just couldn't think of a suitably snappy comeback. The phone rang again. Lori gave Jacob a so-there look, eyebrows raised, chin tucked. Then she got up to answer the phone, hurrying a little to reach it before the fourth ring, when the answering machine would intercept the call. Jacob looked wary. Why was Mom answering the phone? We had already learned not to respond to the ringing. Jacob knew, certainly, that the call was not for him. His friends had all dropped him cold. Anyway, he had never used the telephone much. He considered it intrusive, awkward, archaic, inefficient. Any friend who wanted to speak to Jake would just text him or log into Facebook to chat. These new technologies were more comfortable because less intimate. Jake preferred typing to talking. I felt an instinctive urge to warn Lori not to answer, but I held back. I did not want to spoil the evening. I wanted to support her. These family dinners were important to Lori. Jacob was essentially right. She wanted to preserve as much normalcy as possible. Presumably, that's why she let her guard down. We were laboring to behave like a normal family, and normal families are not afraid of the phone. I said in a coded reminder, "What does the caller ID say?"
"Private caller."
She picked up the phone, which was in the kitchen, in clear view of the dining room table. Her back was to Jacob and me. She said, "Hello," then went silent. Over the next few seconds, her shoulders and back slumped by infinitesimal degrees. It was as if she was deflating slightly as she listened. I said, "Lori?" In a shaky voice, she said to the caller,
"Who is this? Where did you get this number?"
More listening.
"Don't call here again, do you hear me? Don't you dare call here again."
I took the phone from her gently and hung it up.
"Oh my God, Andy."
"Are you okay?" She nodded. We went back to the table and sat quietly for a moment. Lori picked up her fork and scooped a token bit of chicken into her mouth. Her face was rigid, her body still wilted and round-shouldered.
"What did he say?" Jacob asked.
"Just eat your dinner, Jacob." I could not reach her across the table. All I could offer was a concerned face.
"You could star 69 him," Jacob suggested. "Let's just enjoy our dinner," Lori said.
She took another nibble and chewed busily, then sat absolutely stone still. "Lori?" She cleared her throat, mumbled,
"Excuse me,"
and left the table. There were still 151 days to go. Chapter 14. Questioning. Jonathan.
"Tell me about the knife."
Jacob. "What do you want to know?"
"Well, the DA is going to say you bought it because you were being bullied. They'll say that's your motive. But you told your folks you bought it for no reason."
"I didn't say I bought it for no reason. I said I bought it because I wanted it."
"Yes, but why did you want it? Why do you want that necktie? Do you have a reason for everything you buy?"
"Jacob, a knife is a little different from a necktie, wouldn't you say?"
"No, it's all just stuff. That's how our society works. You spend all your time making money so you can trade it for stuff, then now it's gone. Then you go out and make more money so you can buy more stuff. Jacob, the knife is gone?"
"Yeah, my dad took it."
"You have the knife, Andy?"
"No, it's gone."
"You got rid of it?"
"It was dangerous. It wasn't an appropriate knife for a kid to have. It wasn't a toy. Any father would have..."
"Andy, I'm not accusing you of anything. I'm just trying to confirm what happened."
"Sorry. Yes, I got rid of it."
Jonathan nodded, but offered no comment. We were sitting at the round oak table in his office, the only room he had that was large enough to accommodate our entire family. The young associate, Ellen, was there too, assiduously scribbling notes. It occurred to me that she was there to witness the conversation in order to protect Jonathan, not to help us. He was creating a record just in case he ever fell out with his clients and there was a dispute about what he had been told. Lori watched with her hands folded in her lap. Her composure, once so natural, now required more effort to maintain. She spoke a little less, involved herself a little less in these legal strategy sessions. It was as if she was conserving her energy for the moment-to-moment effort of just holding herself together. Jacob was sulking. He picked at the surface of the table with a fingernail, his goofy teenage pride wounded by Jonathan's lack of enthusiasm for his insights into the rudiments of capitalism. Jonathan petted his short beard, absorbed in his own thoughts.
"But you had the knife the day Ben Rifkin was killed."
"Yes."
"Did you have it with you in the park that morning?"
"No."
"Did you have it with you when you left?"
"No."
"Where was it?"
"In a drawer in my room, same as always."
"You're sure?"
"Yeah."
"So when you left for school, was there anything unusual about the morning?"
"When I left? No."
"Did you follow your usual route to school through the park?"
"Yes."
"So the spot where Ben was killed was right on the path you normally follow through the park?"
"I guess so. I never really thought about it that way."
"Before you found the body, did you see or hear anything as you walked through the park?"
"No. I was just walking, and then there he was, just lying there."
"Describe him. How was he lying when you first saw him?"
"He was just lying there. He was, like, lying on his stomach on this, like, little slope and a bunch of leaves."
"Dry leaves or wet leaves?"
"Wet."
"You sure?"
"I think."
"You think or you're guessing?"
"I don't really remember that part too well."
"So why did you answer the question?"
"I'm not really sure."
"From now on, you answer absolutely honestly, okay? If the accurate answer is I don't remember, then that's what you say, all right?"
"All right."
"So, you see a body lying on the ground. Was there any blood?"
"I didn't see any right then."
"What did you do as you approached the body?"
"I kind of called his name, like, Ben, Ben, you okay?" Something like that.
"So you recognized him right away?"
"Yeah."
"How? I thought he was lying face down with his head at the bottom of a slope and you were looking down from above."
"I guess I just recognized, like, his clothes and, you know, his look."
"His look?"
"Yeah, like his appearance."
"All you could see was the bottom of Ben's sneakers."
"No, I could see more than that. You can just tell, you know."
"All right. So you find the body and you say, Ben, Ben. What next?"
"Well, he didn't answer and he wasn't moving, so I figured he must be hurt pretty bad, so I kind of went down to him to see if he was okay."
"Did you call for help?"
"No."
"Why not? Did you have a cell phone?"
"Yeah."
"So you find a victim of a bloody murder and you have a phone in your pocket, but it never occurs to you to call 911?
Jonathan was careful to ask all his questions in a curious tone, as if he was just trying to figure the whole thing out. It was an interrogation, but not a hostile one. Not obviously hostile.
"Do you know anything about first aid?"
"No, I just figured I should see if he was okay first."
"Did it occur to you that a crime had occurred?"
"It occurred to me, I guess, but I wasn't totally sure. It could have been an accident, like if he just fell or something."
"Fell on what? Why?"
"Nothing. I'm just saying."
"So you had no reason to think he just fell?"
"No, you're twisting things. I'm just trying to understand, Jacob. Why didn't you call for help? Why didn't you call your father? He's a lawyer. He works for the DA. He would have known what to do."
I don't know. I didn't think of it. It was kind of an emergency. I wasn't, like, prepared for it. I didn't know what I was supposed to do." "Okay. What happened next?"
"I kind of went down the hill and I got down beside him."
"Got down on your knees, you mean?"
"I guess so."
"In the wet leaves?"
"I don't know. Maybe I stayed standing."
"You stayed standing. So you were looking down over him, right?"
"No, I don't really remember. When you say it like that, I think maybe I must have been down on a knee."
"Derek saw you a few minutes later in school, and he did not say anything about your pants being wet or muddy."
"I guess I must have been standing then."
"All right, standing. So, you're standing over him, looking down at him. What next?"
"Like I said, I kind of rolled him over to check on him."
"Did you say anything to him first?" I don't think so.
You see a classmate lying face down unconscious and you just flip him over without a word?
No, I mean, maybe I said something. I'm not completely sure.
When you were standing over Ben at the bottom of the slope, did you see any evidence of a crime then?
No.
There was a long smear of blood going all the way down the hill from Ben's wounds. You didn't notice it?
No, I mean, I was, like, freaking out, you know?
Freaking out how? What does that mean exactly?
I don't know, just like panicking.
Panicking why? You said you didn't know what happened. You did not think there'd been a crime. You thought it might be an accident.
I know, but this kid was just lying there. It was just a freaky situation.
When Derek saw you just a few minutes later, you weren't freaking out.
No, I was. I just didn't show it. I was freaking out on the inside.
All right. So you're standing over the body. Ben is already dead. He's bled out from three wounds in his chest, and there's a trail of blood leading down the hill to the body, but you didn't see any blood, and you didn't have any idea what happened. And you're freaking out, but only on the inside. What next?
It sounds like you don't believe me.
Jacob, let me tell you something. It doesn't matter if I believe you. I'm your lawyer, not your mom or dad.
Yeah, but still, I don't really appreciate how you're making it sound. This is my story, okay, and you're making it sound like I'm lying.
Lori, who had not spoken throughout this entire meeting, said,
"Please stop, Jonathan. I'm sorry, just please stop. You've made your point."
Jonathan was brought up short, chastened. "All right, Jacob. Your mother's right. Maybe we'd better stop right here. I don't mean to upset you, but I want you to think about something. This whole story of yours might have sounded good when you told it in your head, when you were alone in your room, but things tend to sound different under cross-examination. And I promise you, what we're doing here is a walk in the park next to what Neil LaJudas will do to you if you take the stand. I'm on your side. LaJudas isn't. I'm also a nice guy. LaJudas, well, he has a job to do. Now, I think what you're about to tell me is that, faced with this body lying face down with blood flooding out of three gaping chest wounds, you somehow managed to stick your arm underneath the body so that you could leave a single thumbprint inside Ben's sweatshirt. Yet when you pulled your arm out again, there was not a trace of blood on it, so that when you showed up at school a few minutes later, no one thought anything was amiss. Now, if you were a juror, what would you think about that story?
But it's true. Not the details. You messed me up on the details. He wasn't lying, like, totally face down, and it wasn't like blood was gushing all over. It just wasn't like that. That's just you, you know, playing games. I'm telling the truth.
Jacob, I'm sorry I upset you, but I am not playing games.
I swear to God, it's the truth.
Okay, I understand.
No, you're calling me a liar.
Jonathan did not respond. It is, of course, the last resort of a liar to challenge his inquisitor to call him a liar directly. Worse, there was an edge in Jacob's voice. It might have been the hint of a threat, or it might have been a terrified boy near tears. I said, "Jake, it's all right. Jonathan has a job to do."
"I know, but he doesn't believe me."
"It's okay. He'll be your lawyer whether he believes you or not. Defense lawyers are like that." I gave Jacob a wink.
"What about my trial? How am I going to get up there?"
"You're not," I said. "You're not going anywhere near that witness stand. You're going to sit at the defense table, and the only reason you're going to get up is to go home at night." Jonathan slipped in, "I think that's wise."
"How will I tell my story?"
"Jacob, I don't know if you've been listening to yourself the last few minutes. You cannot take the stand."
"Then what's my defense?"
Jonathan said, "We don't have to present a defense. We have no burden. The burden is entirely on the prosecution. We're going to attack their case at every turn, Jacob, until there's nothing left of it. That's our defense."
"Dad?"
I hesitated. "I'm not sure it's going to be enough, Jonathan. We can't just throw a few spitballs at LaJudas's case. He has the thumbprint. He has the witness who puts a knife in Jacob's hand. We're going to have to do more. We have to give those jurors something."
"So what do you suggest I do, Andy?"
"I just think maybe we need to consider presenting a real affirmative defense."
"Love to. What do you have in mind? As far as I can see, all the evidence points one way."
"What about Pat's? The jury should at least hear about him. Give them the real killer."
"The real killer? Oh my, how do we prove that?"
We'll hire a detective to dig into it.
Dig into what? Pat's? There's nothing there.
When you were in the DA's office, you had the state police, every local police department, the FBI, CIA, KGB, NASA.
We always had less resources than you defense guys imagined.
Maybe, but you had more than you have now, and you never found anything. What's a private detective going to do that a dozen state police detectives couldn't?
I had no answer.
Andy, look, I know you understand that the defense has no burden of proof. You know it, but I'm not entirely sure you believe it. This is how the game is played from the other side. We don't get to pick our clients. We don't get to just drop a case if the evidence isn't there. So this is our case.
He gestured toward the papers in front of him.
We play the cards we're dealt. We have no choice.
Then we have to find some new cards.
Where?
I don't know. Up our sleeves.
I note, Jonathan drawled, that you are wearing a short-sleeved shirt.
Chapter 15. Playing Detective. At the Starbucks in Newton Center, Sarah Grohl had plugged herself into a MacBook. Seeing me, she disengaged herself from the computer, canting her head left, then right to remove her earphones, just as women do when they take off earrings. She looked at me sleepily, blinking, rousing herself from a web trance.
"Hi, Sarah. Am I disturbing you?"
"No, I was just... I don't know."
"Can I talk to you?"
"About what?"
I gave her a look. "Come on. We can go somewhere else if you want." She did not immediately answer. The tables were crowded together, and people pretended not to be listening, obeying the etiquette of coffee shops. But the ordinary awkwardness of having a conversation within others' hearing was multiplied by my family's infamy and by Sarah's own awkwardness. She was embarrassed to be seen with me. She may have been afraid of me, too, after all she had heard. With so much to consider, she seemed unable to answer. I suggested we sit on the park bench across the street, where I figured she would feel safe in the sight of others, yet out of hearing range. And she made a sweeping motion with her head to swing her bangs off her forehead, away from her eyes, and said okay. "Can I buy you another coffee?"
"I don't drink coffee."
We sat side by side on the green slatted bench across the street. Sarah held herself royally erect. She was not fat, but she was not thin enough for the tight T-shirt she wore. A little roll of flesh blossomed over her shorts. A muffin top, the kids called it without embarrassment. I thought she might be a nice girl for Jacob when all this was over. I held my Starbucks paper cup. I'd lost interest in it, but there was no place to dump it now. I turned it in my hands. "Sarah, I'm trying to find out what really happened to Ben Rifkin. I need to find the guy who really did this." She gave me a skeptical sidelong gaze.
"What do you mean, the guy who really did this?"
"Jacob didn't do it. They have the wrong guy."
"I thought that wasn't your job anymore. You're playing detective?"
"It's my job as a father now."
"Okay."
She smirked and shook her head. "Does that sound crazy to say he's innocent?"
"No, I guess not."
"I think maybe you know Jacob is innocent, too. The things you said..."
"I never said that."
"Sarah, you know we adults don't really have any idea what's going on in your lives. How could we? But somebody has to open up to us a little bit. Some of you kids have to help."
"We have."
"Not enough. Don't you see, Sarah? A friend of yours is going to go to prison for a murder he didn't commit."
"How do I know he didn't commit it? Isn't that, like, the whole thing? It's like, how would anyone know that, including you?"
"Well, do you think he's guilty?"
"I don't know."
"So you have doubts?"
"I just said I don't know."
"I do know, Sarah, okay? I've been doing this for a long time, and I know Jacob did not do it. I promise you, he didn't do it. He's completely innocent."
"Of course you think that. You're his father."
"I am, it's true, but I'm not just his father. There's evidence, Sarah. You haven't seen it, but I have." She looked at me with a beneficent little smile, and briefly she was the adult and I was a foolish child.
"I don't know what you want me to say, Mr. Barber. What do I know? It's not like I was tight with either one of them, Jacob or Ben.
Sarah, you were the one who told me to look on Facebook.
I did not.
Okay, well, let's just say if you were the one who told me to look on Facebook. Why did you do that? What did you want me to find?
Okay, I'm not saying it was me that told you anything, okay?
Okay.
Because I don't want to be, like, involved, okay?
Okay.
It was just, you know, there were these rumors going around, and I thought you should know what kids were saying. 'Cause nobody seemed to know, you know? Like, nobody who was in charge. No offense, but you all seemed kind of clueless. Kids knew. Kids were saying Jacob had a knife, and Jake and Ben had a fight. But you guys were running around totally clueless. Actually, Ben had been kind of a bully to Jake for a long time, you know? It wasn't like that makes anyone a murderer, all right? But it was just kind of something I thought you guys should know.
What was Ben bullying Jake about?
Why don't you just ask Jake? He's your kid.
I have. He never mentioned anything about Ben bullying him. All he tells me is everything was just fine. He had no problems with Ben or anyone else.
Okay, then maybe... I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm just wrong.
Come on, you don't think you're wrong, Sarah. What was Jake being bullied about?
She shrugged. Look, it's not like it's such a big deal. Everyone gets bullied. Well, not bullied, teased, okay?
I see how your eyes light up when I say bullied, like it's some big thing. Adults love to talk about bullying. We've had all these training classes in bullying and all that. She shook her head.
Okay, so not bullied, teased.
What about? What were they getting on him about?
The usual stuff. He's gay, he's a geek, he's a loser.
Who was saying that?
Just kids, everyone. It was not a big thing. It happens for a while, then it moves on to the next kid.
Was Ben teasing Jacob?
Yeah, but it wasn't like only Ben. Don't take this the wrong way, but Jacob isn't exactly in the cool crowd.
No? What crowd is he in?
I don't know. He's not really in a crowd. He's just kind of nothing. It's hard to explain. Jacob's kind of like a cool geek, I'd say, only there kind of isn't really such a thing. Does that make sense?
No.
Well, it's like there's jocks. He definitely isn't one of those. And there's smart kids, only he isn't really smart enough to be one of them either. I mean, he's smart, okay, but he isn't like that smart. It's like, you need to have a thing, you know? You need to play an instrument or be on a team or be in a play or whatever. Or, like, be ethnic or lesbian or retarded or something. Not that there's anything wrong with those things. It's just like, if you don't have any of those things, then you're just kind of one of those kids, you know? Like, just a regular kid and nobody knows what to call you. You're nothing, but not in a bad way. And that's kind of like what Jacob was, you know? He was just like a regular kid. Does that make sense?
Perfect sense.
Really?
Yes. What are you, Sarah? What's your thing?
I don't have one. Same as Jacob. I'm nothing.
But not in a bad way.
That's right.
Well, I don't want to get all Cliff Huxtable here, but I don't think you're nothing.
Who's Cliff Huxtable?
Never mind. Across the street, people stole glances at us as they went in and out of Starbucks, though it was not clear if they recognized me. Maybe I was being paranoid.
I just want to say, like...
She searched around for the words.
I think it's really cool what you're trying to do, like trying to prove Jacob innocent and all. You seem like a really good dad. Only Jacob isn't like you.
You know that, don't you?
No. Why? Just like his manner? He's kind of quiet. He's really shy. I'm not saying he's a bad kid. I mean, not at all, but he doesn't have a lot of friends, you know? He has, like, his little circle, like Derek and that kid Josh. That kid is totally weird, by the way. I mean, like, totally random. But Jacob doesn't really have a lot of friends in, like, his network. I mean, I guess he likes it that way, you know? Which is okay. It's totally fine. I'm not saying anything. It's just like there must be a lot going on inside there in his, you know, inside. I don't know if he's happy.
Does he seem unhappy to you, Sarah?
Yeah, a little. But I mean, everyone's unhappy, right? I mean, sometimes. I didn't answer.
You need to talk to Derek. Derek, you? He knows more about all this than I do.
Right now I'm talking to you, Sarah.
No, go talk to Derek. I don't want to get in the middle of it, you know? Derek and Jacob have been really tight, like since they were little kids. I'm sure Derek can tell you more than I can. I mean, I'm sure he'll want to help Jacob. He's like Jacob's best friend.
Why don't you want to help Jacob, Sarah?
I do want to. I don't really know. I don't know enough about it. But Derek does.
I wanted to pat her on the hand or the shoulder or something, but that sort of fatherly contact has been drummed out of us. So I tipped my paper cup toward her in a sort of toast, and I said, "There's something we always asked when we ended an interview in my old job. Is there anything you think I ought to know that I didn't ask about? Anything at all?"
"No, not that I can think of."
"You're sure?" She held up her pinky.
"Promise."
"Okay, Sarah, thank you. I know Jacob's probably not the most popular kid right now, and I think it's very brave of you to talk to me like this."
"It's not brave. If it was brave, I wouldn't do it. I'm not a brave person. It's more like I like Jake. I mean, I don't know about the case and all that, but I used to like Jake, you know, like before. He was a good kid."
Is a good kid.
Is, right.
"Thanks."
"You know what, Mr. Barber? I bet you had, like, a really good father, because, you know, you're like a really good father, so I bet you had a good father who kind of taught you. Am I right?"
"Jesus, didn't this kid read the papers?"
"Not exactly," I said. "Not exactly, but close?"
"I didn't have a father."
"Stepfather?"
I shook my head.
"Everybody has a father, Mr. Barber, except like God or something."
"Not me, Sarah."
"Oh, well, then maybe that's kind of a good thing. Just like take fathers totally out of the equation."
"Maybe. I'm probably not the best guy to ask." The Hughes lived on one of the mazy, shady streets behind the library, near the elementary school where all the kids first met. The house was a tidy little center entrance colonial on a small lot, white with black shutters. A previous owner had built a brick shelter around the front door, which stood out on the white face of the building like a red lipsticked mouth. I remembered crowding into this little compartment when Lori and I used to visit during the winter months. That was back when Jacob and Derek were in grade school. Our families had been friendly then. Those were the days when the parents of Jacob's friends tended to become our friends, too. We used to line up other families like puzzle pieces, father to father, mother to mother, kid to kid, to see if we had a match. The Hughes were not a perfect fit for us. Derek had a little sister named Abigail, 3 years younger than the boys, but the friendship between our families had been convenient for a while. That we saw them less now was not the result of a breakup. The kids had simply outgrown us. They socialized among themselves now, and there had not been enough left of the family friendship to cause either of the parent couples to seek out the other. Still, I felt we were friends, even now. I was naive. It was Derek who answered the door when I rang. He froze, just gawped at me with his big, dumb, syrupy brown eyes until I finally said, "Hi, Derek."
"Hey, Andy."
The U kids had always called Lori and me by our first names, a permissive practice I never quite got used to and which, under the current circumstances, grated all the more.
"Can I talk to you a minute?"
Again, Derek seemed unable to formulate any answer at all. He stared at me. From the kitchen, Derek's dad, David Yu, called,
"Derek, who is it?"
"It's all right, Derek," I reassured him. His panic seemed almost comical. Why on earth was he so rattled? He had seen me 1,000 times.
"Derek, who is it?"
I heard a chair scrape along the kitchen floor. David Yu came out into the front hall, and with a hand placed lightly around the back of Derek's neck, he drew his son back away from the door.
"Hi, Andy."
"Hi, David.
Was there something we can do for you?"
"I just wanted to talk to Derek."
"Talk about what?"
"About the case. What happened? I'm trying to find out who really did it. Jacob is innocent, you know. I'm helping prepare for the trial." David nodded in an understanding way. His wife, Karen, now came out of the kitchen and greeted me briefly, and they all stood together in the doorway like a family portrait.
Can I come in, David?
I don't think that's a good idea.
Why not?
We're on the witness list, Andy. I don't think we're supposed to talk to anyone.
That's ridiculous. This is America. You can talk to whoever you want.
The prosecutor told us not to talk to anyone.
LeJudas?
That's right. He said don't talk to anyone.
Well, he meant reporters. He didn't want you running around making conflicting statements. He's just thinking about the cross-examination. I'm trying to find the truth.
That's not what he said, Andy. He said don't talk to anyone.
Yes, but he can't say that. Nobody can tell you not to talk to anyone.
I'm sorry.
David, this is my son. You know Jacob. You've known him since he was a kid.
I'm sorry.
Well, can I at least come in and we'll talk about it?
No.
No?
No.
We locked eyes.
Andy, he said, this is our family time. I really don't appreciate you being here.
He went to close the door. His wife stopped him, holding the edge of the door, imploring him with her eyes.
Please don't come back here, David, you told me.
He added weakly,
good luck.
He removed Karen's hand from the door and gently closed it, and, I could hear, he slid the chain into the lock. Chapter 16. Witness. I was greeted at the McGraths' apartment door by a dumpy, pie-faced woman with a frizz of unsprung black hair. She wore black spandex leggings and an oversized T-shirt with an equally oversized message stamped across the front. Don't give me attitude. I have one of my own. This witticism ran six full lines, drawing my eyes southward over her person from wavering bosom to detumescent belly, a journey I regret even now. I said, is Matthew here?
Who wants to know?
I represent Jacob Barber.
A blank look.
The murder in Cold Spring Park.
Ah, you his lawyer?
Father, actually.
It's about time. I was beginning to think that kid was all alone in the world.
How's that?
It's just we've been waiting for someone to show up here. It's been weeks. Where's the cops already?
Is Matthew McGrath here? That's your son, I assume.
You sure you're not a cop?
Pretty sure, yeah.
Probation officer?
No.
She put a hand on her hip, tucking it under the little skirt of fat that circled her waist.
I'd like to ask him about Leonard Patz.
I know.
The woman's behavior was so strange, not just her cryptic answers, but the oddball way she looked up at me, that I was slow to grasp what she was saying about Patz.
Is Matt here? I repeated, anxious to be rid of her.
Yeah.
She swung the door open.
Matt! There's someone here to see you.
She shuffled back into the apartment as if she had lost interest in the whole thing. The apartment was small and cluttered. Posh a suburb as Newton is, there are still corners that working people can afford. The McGraths lived in a small two-bedroom apartment in a white vinyl-sided house subdivided into four units. It was early evening, and the light inside was dim. A Red Sox game played on an enormous ancient rear-projection TV. Facing the TV was a mottled, mustard-colored plush armchair into which Mrs. McGrath dropped herself.
You like baseball? She said over her shoulder.
'Cause I do.
Sure.
You know who they're playing?
No.
I thought you said you liked baseball.
I've had some other things on my mind.
It's the Blue Jays.
Ah, the Blue Jays. How could I forget?
Matt!
She blasted.
Then to me.
He's in there with his girlfriend doing God knows what. Kristen, that's the girlfriend. Kid hasn't said two words to me all the times she's been over here. Treats me like I'm a piece of shit. Just wants to go running off with Matt like I don't even exist.
Matt, too, he only wants to be with Kristen. They got no time for me, the both of them.
I nodded.
Oh.
How'd you get our name? I thought sex victims were supposed to be confidential.
I used to be with the DA's office.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I knew that. You're the one. I read about you in the papers.
So you seen the whole file?
Yeah.
So you know about this guy Leonard Patz, what he did to Matt?
Yeah, sounds like he groped him in the library.
He groped him in the balls.
Well, he... Okay, there too.
Matt!
If this is a bad time...
No, you're lucky he's here. Usually he goes off with a girlfriend and I don't even see him.
His curfew's 8:30, but he doesn't care. He just goes off. His probation officer knows all about it. I guess I can tell you that, can't I? He's got a probation officer. I don't know what to do with him. I don't know what to tell anyone anymore, you know. DYS had him for a while, then they sent him back. I moved here from Quincy so he wouldn't be around his friends who were no good. So I came here 'cause I thought it would help him, you know. You ever try to find a Section 8 apartment in this town? Pfft. Me? I don't care where I live. It doesn't matter to me. So you know what? You know what he says to me now, after I do all this for him? He says, "Oh, you've changed, Ma. Now you move to Newton, you think you're fancy. You wear your fancy glasses, your fancy clothes, you think you're like these Newton people." You know why I wear these glasses? She picked up a pair of glasses from a table beside the armrest. "'Cause I can't see. Only now he's got me so crazy I don't even wear them in my own house. I wore these same glasses in Quincy and he didn't say a thing. It's like no matter what I do for him, it's never enough." "It's not easy being a mother," I ventured. "Oh, well, he says he doesn't want me to be his mother anymore. He says that all the time. You know why? I think it's because I'm overweight. It's because I'm not attractive. I don't have a skinny body like Kristen, and I don't go to the gym and I don't have nice hair. I can't help it. This is what I am. I'm still his mother. You know what he calls me when he gets mad? He calls me a fat shit. Imagine saying something like that to your mother, calling her a fat shit. I do everything for this kid, everything. Does he ever thank me? Does he ever say, 'Oh, I love you, Ma, thank you'? No. He just tells me, 'I need money.' He asks me for money, and I tell him, 'I don't have any money to give you, Maddie.' And he says, 'Come on, Ma, not even a couple of bucks.' And I tell him, 'I need that money to buy him all these things he likes, like this Celtics jacket he had to have for 150 bucks. And like a fool, I go and buy it for him just to make him happy.'" The bedroom door opened and Matt McGrath came out, barefoot, wearing only Adidas gym shorts and a T-shirt. "Ma, give it a rest, would you? You're freaking the guy out." The police reports in Leonard Patz's Indecent A&B case described the victim as 14 years old, but Matt McGrath seemed a few years older than that. He was handsome, square-jawed, with a slouchy, wised-up manner. The girlfriend, Kristen, followed him out of the bedroom door. She was not as pretty as Matt. She had a thin face, small mouth, freckles, flat chest. She wore a wide-necked shirt that hung off one side, exposing a milky shoulder and a vampy lavender bra strap. I knew instantly that this boy did not care about her. He would break her heart, probably very soon. I felt sorry for her before she even got all the way out of the bedroom door. She looked about 13 or 14. How many men would break her heart before she was through? "You're Matthew McGrath?" "Yeah, why? Who are you?" "How old are you, Matthew? What's your birth date?"
"August 17th, 1992.
I was distracted momentarily by the thought of it. 1992. How recent it sounded, how far along in my life I was already. In 1992, I had already been a lawyer for 8 years. Lori and I were trying to conceive Jacob in both senses. "You're not even 15 years old yet." "So?" "So, nothing." I glanced at Kristen, who was watching me with a lidded expression like a proper bad girl. "I came to ask you about Leonard Patz."
"Len, what do you want to know?"
"Len, is that what you call him?"
"Sometimes. Who are you again?"
"I'm Jacob Barber's father, the boy who's accused in the Cold Spring Park murder."
"Yeah," he nodded.
"I figured you were something like that. I figured you might be a cop or something, the way you were looking at me, like I'd done something wrong."
"Do you think you've done something wrong, Matt?"
"No."
"Then you've got nothing to worry about, do you? Doesn't matter if I'm a cop or not."
"What about her?"
He inclined his head toward the girl.
"What about her?
Isn't it a crime if you have sex with a kid and she's, like, too young? So it's like, what do they call it?
Statutory rape?"
"Right. Only it doesn't count if I'm too young, too, does it? Like if two kids have sex, you know, with each other, and they're both under the age and they're boning each other..."
His mother gasped.
"Matt!"
"The age of consent in Massachusetts is 16. If 2 14-year-olds have sex, they're both committing rape."
"You mean they're raping each other?"
"Technically, yes."
He gave Kristen a conspiratorial look.
"How old are you, girl?"
16, she said.
"My lucky day."
"I wouldn't go that far, son. The day's not over yet."
"You know what? I don't think I better talk to you about Len or anything else."
Matt, I'm not a cop. I don't care how old your girlfriend is. I don't care what you do. I'm only concerned with Leonard Patz.
You're that kid's father?
Touch of a Boston accent. Father.
Yeah. Your kid didn't do it, you know.
I waited. My heart began to pound.
Len did.
How do you know that, Matt?
I just know.
You know how?
I thought you were the victim in an indecent A and B. I didn't think you knew Len.
Well, it's complicated.
Is it?
Yeah, Lenny and me are friends, kinda.
He's the kind of friend you report to the cops for indecent A and B?
I'll be honest with you. What I reported him for? Lenny never did that.
No? So why'd you report him?
A little grin.
Like I said, it's complicated.
Did he grab you or not?
Yeah, he did.
So what's complicated?
Hey, you know what? I'm not really comfortable with this. I don't think I should be talking to you. I have a right to remain silent. I think I'll go ahead and take that, all right?
You have a right to remain silent with the cops. I'm not a cop. The Fifth Amendment doesn't apply to me. In this room right now, there is no Fifth Amendment.
I could get in trouble.
Matt, son, listen to me. I'm a very patient man, but you're beginning to try my patience. I'm starting to feel... deep breath. Angry, Matt, okay? That's not something I like to feel. So let's stop playing games here, all right? I felt the enormity of the body that houses me. How much bigger I was than this kid. I had the sense I was expanding. I was becoming too big for the room to hold me. If you know something about that murder in Cold Spring Park, Matt, you're going to give it to me. Because, son, you have no idea what I've been through.
I don't want to talk in front of them.
Fine. I clamped my fist around the kid's right upper arm and twisted it, but not twisting it anywhere near the limits of my strength at that moment, because I felt how easily I could separate that arm from his body with just a little torque, how I could tear it off him, skin, muscle, and bone. And I led him into his mother's bedroom, which was furnished, memorably, with a night table comprised of two hood milk crates stacked and turned upside down, and a collage of photos of male movie stars carefully cut out of magazines and scotch-taped to the wall. I closed the door and stood in front of it, arms crossed. As quickly as it had formed, the adrenaline was already receding from my arms and shoulders, as if my body sensed the crisis had passed its peak. The kid had already folded.
Tell me about Leonard. How do you know him?
Leonard came up to me once at McDonald's, like all greasy and pathetic, and he asked